We'd be out of here by now.
Welcome, everybody. I will call the Committee on Implementing Measure 91 to order. We're going to shift around a little bit on the agenda today, but before we open our informational meeting, Chair Leininger and I met today, and we came up with a plan for next steps after tonight. This probably concludes our informational aspect of our work. So we will take Monday off so that we can have time to get into our committee all the bills that have been introduced. And then next week we will select bills that we consider worthy of having hearings on, and they will be hearings only starting on Wednesday. And then on Monday, March 9th, the OLCC will be in to give us their recommendations for legislation they'd like to see. And then after that, there are several more comprehensive bills in the works with work groups, and we will hope to have some more substantial public hearings starting after the OLCC makes their presentation. So tonight is our final informational part of our hearing. Chair Leininger, did you want to add anything to that before we move on?
No, I think that was great. Thank you.
Okay. I will open an informational meeting, and we will start out with the banking and marijuana issue. And we're introducing this topic area will be Judith Gears, from who is the Deputy Chief Counsel for the Department of Justice. There she is.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Judy Gears. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel within the General Counsel Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you for inviting me to provide information on the banking problem. As you're all aware, I'm sure, marijuana businesses have very little access to banking services. The reason for this, of course, is that marijuana is still illegal under federal law. Facilitating a transaction related to marijuana money, even state legal marijuana money, is considered money laundering under federal law. So banks are concerned that dealing with state legal marijuana businesses may expose them to criminal liability. The other problem that many people are less aware of is that the entire federal bank, or the entire banking system, is controlled by the federal government and the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve controls the electronic movement of money throughout the entire country. If you get on the wrong side of the Federal Reserve and lose your ability to deal with the Federal Reserve, you are out of the banking business. And so the difficulty that the banks face is not just the exposure to criminal liability, but they need to be lockstep with the federal authorities in the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department in order to maintain their relationships so that they can operate in this industry. Now, the Treasury Department issued guidance in February of last year. We call that the FinCEN memo. And that was an attempt to create some guidelines to allow banks to do business with marijuana businesses. And there were a number of different things that they were supposed to do, and then the regulators said, and we won't worry about you if you do this. So they were things like verifying with state authorities that a business is duly licensed and registered, securing available information about the business and related parties from the state authorities, understanding the normal and expected activity for the marijuana business, including products sold and type of customers served, monitoring publicly available sources for adverse information, I think that means reading the newspaper, about the cannabis business, account holder, and related parties, and periodically refreshing that information. So you can't just check them out at the beginning when you take their account. You have to keep checking up. Now, the same day that Treasury issued that guidance, US DOJ issued guidance about the enforcement of marijuana-related crimes, financial crimes, I'm sorry. And essentially, I think of this as the Cole memo for banking. So it's the same Cole memo enforcement priorities that you've all seen. And basically what that guidance says is that U.S. DOJ should not go after financial institutions for financial crimes related to state legal marijuana unless the state is not in compliance with the Cole memo. So, did that help? No. Neither of those federal guidance documents really allayed the bankers' fears. In December of this past year, so just a couple of months ago, there was a national conference of state legislatures. At that conference, the senior counsel for the American Bankers Association said that most banks don't want to put themselves in jeopardy by opening accounts or receiving any money, even indirectly, from the sale of marijuana for fear of violating federal money laundering laws and being shut down by the federal regulators. So, what problems does this cause? I think we're all probably pretty aware, but let me just get them on the record. Marijuana businesses are forced to deal largely in cash. They store a lot of cash on the premises, which makes them targets for robbery. They pay their employees in cash, which means their employees walk out of the building on payday as targets for robberies. They pay their taxes and license fees in cash, which creates significant problems for state agencies who are not used to dealing in large amounts of cash. Imagine somebody bringing in $50,000 in taxes, all in fives and tens. The state agencies are not really prepared to deal with large cash payments. Certainly, they will figure out how to do it if that's necessary. Also, cash is ferried around in armored vehicles with armored guards, which of course increases the expenses for these businesses enormously, or people try to avoid those expenses by putting the cash in nondescript vehicles with nondescript looking people, hoping to just sort of fly under the radar of folks that would spot them as somebody taking $50,000 in cash over to a bank that will accept their deposits. So it creates a lot of public safety problems. In addition, without banking records, it's very hard to audit businesses and make sure that they are indeed playing by all the rules. The businesses, by and large, also have no access to loans for capital improvement, expansion. Like, unlike other businesses, if they're doing well, they can't go get a loan. So being closed out of the banking system frustrates the business's abilities to grow and prosper. It encourages less than careful bookkeeping, and it frustrates the state's ability to monitor and regulate those businesses. Now, I'm not coming to you with any kind of solution for this problem, unfortunately. Colorado did... This is sort of a little depressing story here. Colorado chartered a state credit union called the Fourth Corner Credit Union. It was a group of entrepreneurs that saw that providing banking services in Colorado would be a very good business. They went through all the state regulatory requirements. They got a license. They went to the feds to get their master account through the Federal Reserve System. Normally, a business that has a state license, a financial institution with a state license, gets that master account within days. They've been waiting 4 months. The word on the street is that it is unlikely that they will ever get that master account. So I'm just here today to tell you that the banking problem is significant. DOJ is thinking about all of this in our role of trying to help the state develop a viable industry here, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. You mentioned two memos, the FinCEN memo and a DOJ memo that was issued, I think you said, the same day?
Yeah, February 2014.
Right. Could you provide the committee with, just our administrator would be fine with copies of that?
Yes,
I'd be. We may already have them, but I want to make sure those are available to the committee. Do we have questions?
I do.
For that, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, ma'am. So you mentioned a couple of the prohibitions that are in federal law. Can you just describe some examples of the nexus that would trigger a federal attention in the marijuana business, the whole idea that we all know that growing marijuana on federal land would be one of those prohibitions, just you can't do it.
Yes.
But there are dozens of others. I wonder if you could just give me some examples of the nexus that would bring federal attention to the to that activity.
Co-Chair Burdick, Senator Farioli. The difficulty is that we don't have a lot of prosecutions to look at. What we have is the Cole memo. So essentially, if the federal government feels that you are that a marijuana business is operating outside of state law, or that they're operating within state law, but state law is not properly compliant with Cole memo requirements, then the feds can step in and prosecute. But frankly, there is nothing that stops them from prosecuting. They can, at any point, withdraw these memos. They can prosecute without withdrawing the memos. The memos were very careful to retain discretion by the U.S. attorneys to prosecute any federal crime.
Madam Chair, just to follow up. It's all right, so I think we get the idea that, well, actually, we've been told on the committee that warehousing cannabis products in the OLCC warehouse at Oregon City might jeopardize the status of that facility as a bonded warehouse because federal statute apply there. And you know, that would be enough of a nexus to possibly trigger a problem. So I don't understand the idea that you could have a problem at the liquor warehouse but not a problem at the outlets at the OLCC stores. I see a nexus there. And I'm wondering how far you can transfer or how far you can thread those issues. Interstate highways are federally funded. Would that be if you transport marijuana on interstate highways within the state of Oregon, is that enough of a nexus to trigger enforcement? If you benefit from federal programs or are subject to federal regulations or connect with some sort of a federal benefit, is that enough to trigger federal attention to the issue?
Senator Burdick, Senator Farioli, I'm sorry, I'm new to this testifying thing. I'm not sure I'm understanding your question, but I think the answer might be there are no rules about what can and can't trigger a federal investigation or a federal criminal prosecution other than the current federal laws, which say marijuana is illegal. Any financial transactions in marijuana can be money laundering. So I don't want to step outside my bounds, but essentially the federal government has not tied its hands at all with any of these guidance memos. And the state proceeds forward in the hope that we will do a good job with creating a legal marijuana industry such that the feds don't come in to squash it. I think that's how Colorado is operating. That's how Washington is operating. And there are, I'm afraid, there are no guarantees, although I would like to pass along one sort of hopeful statement that was made by the U.S. Attorney for Colorado at the big Colorado Marijuana Conference that happened in January, which was that legal marijuana is coming to the U.S. Within 10 or 20 years, everyone will have it. And state legislatures, and he was largely speaking to police officers in that audience, everybody needs to figure out how to do it right. So this was the U.S. Attorney for Colorado. saying that he doesn't think that the feds will come in and squash the program in Colorado. USDEA, over the same region, stood up and said the same thing. So I do think that that was some small assurance that if the state does its best to follow the Cole memo, it might be okay.
Thank you. Representative Buck.
It sounds like the Cole memo, you know, how they say qualifying everything, it might be okay.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When in describing the effort in Colorado to do the credit union idea, you mentioned the federal master account. I don't know what that is. Can you tell me what that master account is and why it is essential to have that for the credit union?
Well, so I'm not a banking expert. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can I interrupt here? We are going to have banking experts. Can you wait
absolutely.
On that question?
Absolutely. We can wait till someone who can think.
That's wonderful. Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think the other thing is following what Senator Farioli says, maybe another, review looking back at our medical marijuana program that's been in effect since 1999, if I'm not mistaken. Sure. So it's about 15 years. We have not had them intervene because we have, I think, stayed within the bounds of what was passed by the voters and have done regulatory to the point. And I understand there's the leakage and stuff, and now we're trying to work on that. But that seems to me to be maybe somewhat of an indicator. So long as we continue to good faith effort, they might not come in and bother us.
Senator Burdick, Senator Pozanski, yes, I think that's a fair statement. And, you know, they have prosecuted in California.
California, for sure.
But, you know, it's about 26 or 27 states now that have medical marijuana. Now we have four with retail. You know, the trend is in this direction.
Yep.
I think all that the state can do is try its best to create a well-regulated, well-controlled industry.
So I had another question, but it might be for the banking people.
I think, yeah, I'd like to direct this back toward the banking. We're talking more about the general enforcement now, and I really would like to direct our attention to banking. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. You mentioned the federal prosecutor for Colorado. Has DOJ had any discussions with the federal prosecutor for Oregon?
I am not aware of any.
Okay.
I think that might be on our agenda at some point. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our next panel will be the credit unions. We have Hal Scoggins, Pam Levitt, and Alan Hansen. And Ms. Levitt, I know that you have a whole cadre of people that are waiting on you, so feel free to present your testimony. We can ask you. You can leave at any point.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Pam Levitt, here today representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. The Northwest Credit Union Association represents 160 credit unions in Oregon and Washington, about 1.5 million members in Oregon. We hope through the testimony you are going to receive today, you're going to hear about the challenges and barriers credit unions have had in Washington State and Colorado in serving some of the marijuana-related businesses and some of the issues we're going to be facing here in Oregon. I have a couple different folks to testify. Hal Scoggins represents credit unions in Oregon and the association. And as any good attorney would do, he has provided you four long pages of testimony outlining the Cole memo and several regulatory issues, but he will be brief in his testimony. You should have all of our testimony, including an article that I submitted from Credit Union Times on OLIS. And then Alan Hansen with MAPS Credit Union has a very specific story to tell you about serving a dispensary in our state. Before I turn that over, I just want to read to you a couple things. May 23rd, 2014, the governors of Washington and Colorado sent a letter to federal regulators saying banks and, 20 years ago when I testified, I didn't need these, and, you know, unfortunately now I do. Banks and credit unions in Colorado and Washington are waiting for federal banking agencies to furnish the instructions given to bank and credit union examiners before deciding whether and how to provide banking services to state-licensed recreational marijuana businesses. In the meantime, product sales have already begun in Colorado and were soon to begin in Washington. Again, this was May 2014. Exposing all involved to significant risks in criminal activity associated with accepting, storing, and transporting large quantities of cash that can be accessed by the banking system. This was a letter the governors had sent to federal regulators after the Cole memo came out. And the response was basically, we're looking at FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. We're looking at the Bank Secrecy Act. But they said in their letter, further clarity from Congress on the legal treatment of state-licensed marijuana-related businesses under federal law would provide greater legal certainty for both marijuana-related businesses and banks and credit unions. So I just wanted to outline that these letters are going back and forth, lots of confusion for certainly credit unions that are looking at this in Washington State and some of the challenges that I believe we're going to have here in Oregon. And I'll turn it over to Hal.
Good evening, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Wada Witt in Portland, and we represent credit unions all throughout the Pacific Northwest and the Northwest Credit Union Association as well. As you've heard already, the primary source of the problem that confronts financial institutions who desire to serve marijuana-related businesses is the simple fact that marijuana production, distribution, and consumption remains illegal under federal law. There's nothing that can be done at the state level to change that. However, based on the current environment we're in, the Cole memo that you've all heard about, the other regulatory issues that we face, there are things that the state can do to at least facilitate the process and minimize the hurdles that are faced by financial institutions, if that is in fact the desire. There are three basic problems that confront financial institutions in serving marijuana-related businesses. One, based on the illegality under federal law, is the concept of aiding and abetting, money laundering. You've heard about potentially, you could even argue, violations of RICO, that credit unions would be participating in criminal enterprises by serving these businesses. That is one possibility. I would put that at the lower end of the risk scale in terms of likelihood, based on simply public and political pressure and the positions that have been set forth in the Cole memo and other things that we've heard from the federal end. Next in the scale of likely risks is the issue that if you are making a loan to one of these businesses, you could be subject to having your collateral seized if the federal government determines that there's been ongoing violation of federal law that warrants seizure and forfeiture under federal laws. And normally when that happens, if a borrower is doing something illegal, using property that you have a trust deed on to conduct illegal activity, that property is seized under federal law. You can file documentation indicating that the credit union was not aware of the illegal activity, and as long as that's proven, then your security interest will be recognized and you'll get the value of the collateral back, or you might get the collateral itself back. You won't be negatively impacted that much by the seizure. Of course, if you're serving a marijuana-related business, knowing that it's a marijuana-related business, you lose that ability to assert that defense. And so you could be subject to the loss of your collateral, not to mention the fact that the business that you've made a loan to has now lost its way to continue to generate income. So there's certainly a risk in terms of making loans to these businesses. And then last and probably highest on the risk list, and certainly in terms of the burden and the hurdles in serving these businesses on a day-to-day basis, is compliance with the Federal Bank Secrecy Act, which was put into place years and years ago. And it's really, to boil it down to a nutshell, it's the opposite of the Defense Department's old don't ask, don't tell rule. It is instead ask and tell, and in fact, investigate and tell. You have to know who you're dealing dealing with, who you're opening accounts for, and what kind of activity they're conducting, and if that activity is illegal or might be illegal or crosses certain other boundaries, then you have to report it to FinCEN, as has been referred to before, which is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. That's an arm of the Treasury Department and sort of a clearinghouse for information. And what happened last August when the Cole memo was issued, the federal government, at least informally, of course it's not a regulation, can be rescinded at any time, but at least informally the Justice Department said, we won't prosecute marijuana-related businesses, we won't pursue criminal action against related parties as long as these eight Cole memo priorities are not implicated in the actions of the enterprise that you're dealing with. That really didn't do credit unions any good in terms of serving these businesses because we still had to comply with the Bank Secrecy Act, which requires us to file what's called a suspicious activity report anytime we know that the business or individual is using the credit union to facilitate criminal activity. And there are other triggers as well, but that's the key one. So in February of last year, 2014, FinCEN came out with guidance, again, that's already been referred to, that would tell financial institutions, okay, here's how you can comply with the Bank Secrecy Act and still serve businesses that are dealing with marijuana on a day-to-day basis. You have to do investigation to determine whether those businesses are violating any of the Cole memo priorities. You have to understand the nature of their business. You have to make sure they're appropriately licensed under state law. And you have to do ongoing due diligence, not just initial at the opening of the account, but you have to do that due diligence on an ongoing basis. And if anything has changed, then you have to report on that change to FinCEN. And last but not least, if it turns out that something has changed, then you probably have to terminate the relationship and then file a final suspicious activity report telling FinCEN why you've terminated that relationship. That gives you some comfort that you've complied with the Bank Secrecy Act. Of course, it imposes a whole huge amount of work that has to be done by the credit union in terms of being sure that it knows who it's dealing with and what the scope of the operations are. It's almost as if you were making a loan to the business in the first place. You really have to send people out to their premises, interview, find out what type of business they're engaging in, who their customers are, what type of sale or other activity they're involved in, and get a feel for yourself of whether their business is violating any of the Cole memo priorities. And if you've done that, and then if you've got the proper paperwork in order, you can be at least semi-confident that you have complied with the Bank Secrecy Act requirements and that the credit union won't be prosecuted based on the assurances contained in the Cole memo. Those are risks that, of course, credit unions and other financial institutions can evaluate for themselves in terms of whether and to what extent they want to get involved in that. But based on the requirements in the Cole memo and in the FinCEN guidance that's been issued to credit unions and financial institutions, there are some things that the state can do to, again, minimize the hurdles, minimize the risks involved. One of those is to develop a robust regulatory regime for marijuana-related businesses. That is something that's explicitly mentioned in the Cole memo and in the other Department of Justice memo that accompanied the FinCEN guidance last year. They say the exercise of our discretion, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, the exercise of our prosecutorial discretion assumes a robust regulatory regime in the state. And if that's not there, then essentially all bets are off. One of the things also that a credit union has to do in order to satisfy the Bank Secrecy Act in serving these businesses is to get a copy of the license, of course, but also the license application and all the supporting documentation that was submitted with the license application and do confirming work with the state. So one of the things that the state would need to do, again, to lower the barriers, make the hurdles less, would be to ensure that in this robust regulatory regime, the license, documentation, application, all of the states file is readily available to financial institutions for review so that they can satisfy their requirements under the Cole memo. And finally, as also was mentioned before, an ongoing dialogue and communication with the federal government, presumably local representatives of the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Oregon, and others that may be involved, healthy communication with them to ensure that they're in agreement that the state's regulatory regime is robust and that what the state's doing, if it's followed, will help ensure that the Cole memo priorities aren't violated, and find out if there are problems at the federal end that can be headed off through whatever sort of regulatory action or change is necessary at the state level. And again, that will further protect financial institutions in Oregon from as much as can be done from the risk that's involved in serving these businesses. I will end it there. I have links to all of those memos, the FinCEN memos, the Cole memo, and the other Department of Justice memo in my testimony. And I'd be happy to answer questions if I can.
Thank you. Mr. Hansen, did you want to add to that, or are you here as a resource?
I was planning on adding to that.
Great. Why don't you testify, and then we'll take questions.
Good evening, Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Alan Hansen. I'm the General Counsel and Compliance Officer for MAPS Credit Union, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the credit union's experience in the medical marijuana dispensaries. In February of last year, through normal compliance monitors, we discovered what we believed that we may be serving a medical marijuana dispensary. This was at the same time that FinCEN was issuing its guidance, and we reviewed those requirements, and we made the determination that we were going to close the account just because of the burden imposed on us. On the morning of February 28th, I was about to contact this dispensary and tell them that we discovered they were a dispensary.
You could speak up just a little bit.
Thank you. I apologize. On February 28th, we were planning on calling them and telling them we weren't going to continue to serve that account, but I picked up the Statesman Journal, and there was a front page article about that particular dispensary indicating that the Marion County Commissioners had passed an exclusion on dispensaries in the county. And we determined that, then that was the only one business that exclusion was impacting. So we contacted senior management, and we determined that it might be reputation risk if we made it known that we were serving this entity. So we decided that we would go ahead and figure out how to comply with the Cole memo and the FinCEN guidelines. And so we did our due diligence. We met with the dispensary owner. And we've learned a lot about the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and based on the rules in place regarding where the dispensary can purchase its product, the record-keeping requirements on who it sells to, that we could go ahead and we believe that we can comply with those with Cole memo priorities. In preparation of the passage of recreational, we've been in contact by a lot of growing operations, edible manufacturing, and potential retail outlets, and we've declined to say whether we would serve them or not, just because with the medical program, the state has cradle-to-grave monitoring of where the product comes from, how it's handled, and who it goes to, where we're not sure what's going to happen outside of that program. So at this point, we don't know whether we'll be able to or not. And again, we're here. We take no position on whether we should make it legal under federal law or not, but we're just here to review, the new rules and whether we will go forward with recreational dispensaries or not.
Okay.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Scott, it's me. Could you answer the question I had earlier about the Colorado experience and what exactly, because I just don't understand the elements of what they were looking for from the federal government and did not receive?
Coach Burdick, Coach Leininger, Representative Buckley, I don't have all of the details, and I'm not an expert in the financial end of it. What I can tell you is there are a couple of federal issues at play. One is whether the credit union gets federal deposit or share insurance, and the answer is that they don't have that yet. They have applied for it. The comment that was made about their Federal Reserve Master account is probably equally applicable to whether they get federal share insurance at any time before federal law changes on the legalization. In terms of their ability to operate on a day-to-day basis, they're there doing something. I'm not quite sure what. Anybody who makes a deposit there, that deposit is uninsured, but certainly people are willing to deal with them on that basis, or at least some people are. So I'm not sure of the scope of what they are actually doing at this particular point in time without share insurance and without the account at the Fed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bolson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is my night. So, Hal, I guess my question is directed towards you, and I'm looking at your letter that you sent us. I'm looking at the one part that talks about continuing due diligence requirements and your 3 points that you've already shared with us here. The second bullet I find interesting, ongoing monitoring for suspicious activity. You're going to be profiling? I'm just joking. What are you going to do for that? I mean, are you going to be training your folks to recognize what suspicious behavior is? I mean, I would think that, yeah, you're going to almost have to kind of draw into that law enforcement perspective to a degree.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, Representative Olson, you are accurate, I believe, in that statement. Although I would say, from the credit union perspective, we are already under that obligation with all of our members. It's just that this is a particular type of business that poses a particular increased type of risk, and also probably a more specialized knowledge of how they're doing what they're doing and the scope of the Cole Memo priorities. The FinCEN has helpfully provided a list of red flags to be looking for, but those certainly aren't the only things that you have to be looking for. And in terms of the burden of the ongoing due diligence, it's absolutely there. And again, because of the nature of the business and the fact that it is illegal under federal law, that burden is intense and is ongoing. And so, yeah, you do have to be at their business, I think, or hire someone else to be at their business on a regular basis to make sure that they are doing what they tell you they're doing, that for instance, they're not distributing marijuana in a way that would find itself into the hands of minors or across state lines to some place where it's not been legalized under that state's law, any of the other priorities. You really have to do a fair amount of due diligence, much more so than on any other business, in order to satisfy those requirements. And that is expensive. And I will tell you, there are credit unions in Washington that are doing this to some extent or another. But in terms of how expensive it is, I can tell you that there is one credit union in Washington that, to provide these services, it's a flat fee, and this is just for a deposit relationship, no loans. But to open a deposit relationship and maintain that relationship, they pay a flat fee of $250 or $500, I think, an application fee. Then they pay another flat monthly fee that's not that large. Then they also pay a deposit and withdrawal fee of 35 basis points, 0.35%, for everything that you deposit into and withdraw from your account. So if you are depositing $100,000, you'll pay $350 that month. If you're withdrawing $100,000, you'll pay another $350 that month if you're the business, simply because it is a very costly effort to engage in at the credit union.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I wasn't done, but you know, I'm patient. I'm a patient man. I can wait.
I'll wait.
I can
wait.
Apologies.
I'll wait. It's okay. I'll wait.
No.
You have at it.
you're both pointing at each other. I yield back to Representative
Olson. I like it. Thank you, Senator. Okay, so I find this intriguing, to be truthful with you, and getting back to the due diligence, but then also you said something in kind of toward your closing comments on about ongoing dialogue that you're going to have to maintain. And I got that with the Department of Justice for what you're doing. I would think that it would behoove us something fierce, be truthful with you, that whatever we craft here is going to be of a package that would give you some support, at least for credibility, of that we're doing some good law here to protect you as well as folks needing the medical marijuana, as well as those who would like to have recreational use, besides stopping the black market.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leninger, Representative Olson, to clarify, what I intended to say was that the ongoing dialogue with the federal representatives, especially here in Oregon, I believe should be occurring at the state level, at the state regulatory level, and at the legislative level as you craft whatever you're in the process of crafting, so that the federal authorities are confident that the state regulatory regime is robust, and so that they've provided guidance to the state on what they need, at least at this particular point in time under this administration, what they need in order to be confident in the state's regulatory scheme. And that will give financial institutions the assurance that they need, more so than the institutions themselves having the dialogue.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You done?
Affirmative.
Are you sure?
I am.
Senatorialist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to digress for a second, but there's a point here. In 1997, we worked very hard as a body to prevent the listing of the coastal coho salmon. And we were successful. We did prevent the listing. It flipped over when litigation was brought at the federal level, and we ended up with the listing. But out of that frustration came an approach that involved a robust system of restoration and protection, and then the entry into memorandums of understanding initially, and then memorandums of agreement with federal agencies, and the principles of which were, if you do thus, you will have safe harbor. Hmm. So I was wondering if, you know, what I'm hearing you describing is the absence of safe harbor, because you can't rely on the Cole Memorandum in the face of potential regime change, which from time to time happens. And so the thing that would be binding even in the face of regime change would be a written memorandum of agreement between the parties. And in this case, it would be the Department of Justice and the, you know, and the banks and credit unions, you know, affirming and asserting that they'll follow the principles of the Cole Memorandum, but receiving in return a flat statement that's legally defensible, that if you follow those principles, you will not be prosecuted. You know, you have a safe harbor to operate within. A framework to operate within is what's missing from the Cole Memo. You know, they're talking about refraining, which is a nice thought, but you still are essentially seated under an anvil that could fall at any minute. And that is an unacceptable risk, not for your business, but for your members. So safe harbor is the principle I think that's missing here, Madam Chair.
I think right now that risk is reflected in the fees. Is that correct?
No, the fees are perfectly reasonable.
What Senator Pazanski?
Thank you. On the banking issue, it sounds to me that both Colorado and Washington has at least two institutions, one each, that's actually in the process or actually taking some type of deposits and transactions, if I understood. So without the federal insurance, it just basically means whoever, you know, is buyer beware or customer beware, that your deposits you're making aren't going to be insured. Is that too elementary of a statement?
Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, Senator Pozanski, that is correct. I would also point out, however, in Washington, there is no credit union that does not have federal insurance, and they have to have federal insurance. Colorado does not require federal insurance. They do, but a credit union can actually start and begin operations if it has applied for federal insurance, even though it hasn't actually received it. In Oregon, that would not be possible. You cannot begin your credit union operations until you have your certificate from the National Credit Union Administration.
One follow-up.
Please follow-up.
Is it possible for the state to actually somehow establish a financial institution for this purpose if we choose to do that? Not saying we would, but we could actually have some type of a mechanism that would allow for that type of commerce to take place without having any type of federal insurance.
Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, Senator Pruszynski, I believe you could do that. I mean, at the risk of being flip, you're the legislature. You can make the laws. It would require substantial legislative change, I believe. But it could. I don't see why it couldn't happen.
Okay.
Thank you. So let me get this clear. Is it an option to ensure to not provide insurance for marijuana-based businesses and provide insurance for other types of depositors? Or did I misunderstand that?
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, that is not currently an option. And in fact, that I don't think would be an option at all. Either the institution itself is insured or it's not insured. Yeah. And if it is insured, then there's no mechanism, other than limitations on the amount of insurance and that one person can have and how various types of accounts are insured. But the whole institution is insured or it's not. And so you would have to charter a completely separate institution that is not subject to the current requirements that exist in Oregon that you have federal deposit or share insurance.
Has your industry ever talked about having a marijuana-only credit union?
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, there are people that have talked about that. Some of them have talked to me about that. I would not venture to say that our industry has talked about that.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. A question for you. What pattern or structure of transactions triggers SARs? Suspicious activity reports.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, Representative Wilson, in general, there are specific triggers that apply, again, to anyone with an account. Generally speaking, it's triggered if the credit union becomes aware that the account is being used to facilitate illegal activity. That's sort of a paraphrase and a general statement, but that's one of the key triggers, which created the whole problem in the first place. Obviously, if it's a marijuana-based business, you know all their activity is illegal. And that's what made it essentially impossible to serve these businesses knowingly until the FinCEN guidance came out last year, which essentially said the requirement to file a suspicious activity report is in the federal statutes. It is not a regulatory requirement. It's a statutory requirement. And here at FinCEN, we don't have the authority to change the statute, but what we can do is provide this sort of junior SAR, the Marijuana Limited SAR, suspicious activity report that can be filed, and we'll say that satisfies your requirement for filing the suspicious activity report. And I don't mean that, again, too lightly. It simply is a report that you file after you've done all the due diligence that we've discussed, but rather than having to file it on an ongoing basis and go through all of the reporting requirements that you do with a normal suspicious activity report, it simply says they're engaged in marijuana activity that is permissible under state law. Boom. Okay. That's the end of it.
Just a quick follow-up. You know, I've known just regular folks who are careful about how they structure their cash transactions to avoid SARs being filed on them. A lot of people, I think, have always figured that the SARs just went to some dusty old warehouse someplace and nobody ever paid any attention to them. But are you aware of that kind of thing where just the average Joe is careful about how they handle their cash transactions so not to raise red flags.
Coach Herbertic, Coach Erlininger, Representative Wilson, yes. And I would distinguish between two types of reports here, not to go too far afield, and I'll be brief. Right. There's a currency transaction report, which is filed anytime someone does a cash transaction over $10,000. And some people have been known to try to structure their transactions to avoid the currency transaction filing requirement.
I
will say that the structuring itself, if it is detected, is cause for filing a suspicious activity report. And credit unions are routinely examined on Bank Secrecy Act compliance, and that's one of the things that they get dinged on by the examiners is if they are not closely scrutinizing cash transactions enough to determine if someone is structuring them so as to avoid the currency transaction requirement.
Thank you.
Representative Leininger.
Thank you. I've worked with community development financial institutions at times, and I know that they have some unique roles, and they can provide capital to underserved areas or blighted areas. Is there any way in which a CDFI could step in, perhaps if it were serving particularly a part of the state that has a lot of economic crisis to fill some of this role? They can be really small, narrow entities that could conceivably only serve that kind of business. Is that something not the industry, but perhaps those individuals have talked about?
Coach Erlininger, Coach Herbertic, that is something that I don't think would provide any relief from the primary hurdles that we've talked about tonight. Those types of institutions are still subject to all of the same Bank Secrecy Act requirements, as well as the same legal and operational risks that would apply to other financial institutions. They do have some capabilities in terms of raising capital and doing other things that make other aspects of what they do more easy to serve the underserved. But it would not provide them, at least from what I can tell, would not provide them any relief on this particular topic.
May I make one?
Yes, please.
Thanks. So the testimony that you three have provided is really interesting and important, and I think as our committee is considering some things like who may have a beneficial interest in marijuana-related businesses, the lack of access to capital through some traditional means, at least right now, may really have to factor into our decision about where people can appropriately get money from, you know, because people may need loans, people may need personal loans, family loans from folks who don't necessarily live in Oregon in order to bridge the fact that we don't have access to capital in some of the traditional ways for this sector right now.
We've got to move this along, so
just one
very short.
Someone confused. Okay, so you can jump through a whole lot of hoops and operate. You're still not connected to the Federal Reserve, and so you still don't have a way to get the money into the system unless you set up some sort of legal laundering sort of operation. But isn't that a catch-22?
Coach Erlininger, Coach Herbertic, Senator Cruz, I, to be honest, I don't have a good answer for that. It may be that somebody from the banking panel will have a better answer for that, but I'm not that person.
I mean, we can dance all around this, but if it's still outside of the system, it's outside of the system. So, you know, I think that's an important question.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. It's been very helpful. Okay, our next panel is the banks. Linda Navarro, Jeff Baker, and Casey Ryan. Navarro.
Got a better answer?
Not Navarro. I've got
you. Somebody got to get it inside the system, don't you?
Welcome to the committee. 2 days in a row we get the bankers.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, Chair Leininger. Members of the committee, Linda Navarro, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. We represent all of the banks doing business in the state of Oregon, including the state chartered banks, as well as the federal banks and the national banks doing business in our state. I'm pleased to be here today. Thank you for the invitation. You've already received a lot of testimony, so I'm really going to try not to be redundant, but maybe add a little bit of color to some of the issues that were discussed that impact the ability of financial institutions to bank marijuana-related businesses in this state. And then I'm going to turn it over to the real experts that are up here with me, who are guests from MBank, and they are a bank that's actually attempting to serve businesses in this space. So I'm sure they can answer some of your questions. To begin with, I just want to say that the banking industry really doesn't have any position on whether marijuana should be legalized or not from a medicinal or recreational purpose, but we feel very, very strongly as an industry that if a business is legal, it should have access to legitimate banking services. Operating an industry in a largely cash basis presents a lot of risks and is an invitation to increased criminal activity. That can be crimes related to cash, but it can also be crimes committed in terms of failing to disclose properly information to financial institutions and maybe trying to circumvent some of the barriers to accessing banking services. So for the Know Your Customer requirements and the transparency, it's important to us that everything can happen for these businesses above board and that they have access to services. At the same time, I'd point out that from a state standpoint, I'm sure the tax collection issue and some of those related financial issues are another good argument for why banking services would be important in this industry. But you've heard today from several folks that testified already that there are barriers for banks to really fully engage in serving the marijuana-related businesses in our state, both under the medicinal program and likely under the recreational program. The four different memos, including the Cole memo from the Department of Justice, have attempted to provide some clarity about when a financial institution could be subject to enforcement. And those are basically laid out in the eight priorities you've heard about. One of the memos I provided you, actually two of them, detail those eight priorities. You've talked a little bit about what those are, but, you know, it's obvious things like selling to minors, doing business with cartels, but the devil's in the details for banks, and knowing how and when that activity might be taking place is part of the due diligence that is spelled out in more detail in the FinCEN memo, which is the memo that's been referenced that I've also provided. And it deals with the Bank Secrecy Act and monitoring, so that customer monitoring piece. And then, of course, the SAR filings and how you comply with those requirements are detailed in that memo. So a lot of banks in the state of Oregon and in Colorado, in fact, speaking of Colorado, I know of at least seven banks that are banking marijuana businesses in the state of Colorado. And in Washington, and in, frankly, in any state that's implementing a medicinal marijuana regime, is in every one of those cases, you have the majority of banks opting out of serving this industry because of the risk posed by not only compliance with the guidance, but just the uncertainty that comes with violating federal law under DOJ guidance that's temporary in nature. Senator Farioli, I heard you mention the change in regime. I mean, we talk about that all the time because certainly a change in attorney general and a change in administration at the federal level could change the interpretation of how they want to respond to marijuana-related business. We believe at the end of the day that the action that would actually really change the dynamic and make most banks comfortable, or many more banks comfortable in serving this industry, is it requires congressional action. It requires Congress to either, for states that have legalized marijuana, take marijuana off of the Controlled Substances Act, or on top of that, or in a, or even separate from that, they could also pass legislation like legislation that Representative Perlmutter out of introduced that would acknowledge that banks that bank legitimate marijuana businesses, regulated marijuana businesses under a state regime, would not be subject to criminal prosecution. So that express action by Congress is what we would like. But unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen in the near future. I do think, as the credit union panel mentioned, ongoing dialogue between public officials in Oregon and folks involved in the industry in Oregon, with both the Department of Justice and FinCEN on the law enforcement side, and with bank regulators, you know, the FDIC and the OCC and the folks that come into banks every year and examine them, they also need to know that a robust system of supervision and regulation of the industry is in place in Oregon, and they also... in my opinion, it doesn't hurt if Oregon stepped up with what we've seen the governors in Colorado and Washington do in sending letters to various agencies, calling on them to issue more clarity for banks in this space. So far, frankly, the FinCEN and the DOJ memos or guidance, they've helped a great deal, and MBank can talk about how they're trying to forge a path forward under that guidance. But they're limited, and the federal banking regulators have not issued any written guidance whatsoever in this space. It's pretty much oral conversations, or more likely, it's the experience a bank has after they go through an exam and determine how the FDIC responded to their program. I say FDIC, but it could be the OCC or the state bank regulators as well. So we're still only seeing this play out, but encouragingly, there are more banks entering that space slowly but surely, along with credit unions. To the point about a state bank, I'll just say that a state bank would still have many of the challenges that another bank would have with, as far as like being able to offer access to the payment system, you know, the ability to accept debit and credit cards, and some of those factors, and likely, of course, those deposits would not be insured by a federal insurance agency like the FDIC. I'm hoping we can find a path forward through traditional financial institutions in this state that, that are interested in serving this community. But it's going to take some additional action at the federal level, I think, before we see the majority of banks entering this space. So with that, I'll pause. I'm happy to answer any questions now or later.
Wait till we hear from MBank, which I've been dying to hear from.
Yes,
to,
of course.
Someone who's actually actually trying to get into this market.
Madam Chair, are you going to offer the opportunity for them to take the Fifth Amendment?
Yeah, no pressure. Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Lindinger, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Baker, President and CEO of MBank, headquartered in Gresham, Oregon. With me, Casey Ryan, also with MBank, Director of Corporate Development. Let's see. So you guys have heard, I think, from a lot of the experts, attorneys, about the challenges in this space. And, you know, I think everybody's kind of highlighted that this is a dangerous place to be. You know, the federal pressure is real. And so you're not going to see too many financial institutions enter this space. You know, for us, I think the best thing I can tell you that tips the scale, you know, we feel we have an obligation to provide services to an underserved community. And, you know, that I think that necessarily isn't the same sentiment that a lot of financial institutions share. So as a result, I think you're going to see a lot of people nervous and concerned about that federal pressure. So, you know, it's a tough place to be. It's a scary place to be. It's a long period of risk assessment to get to a decision like this. For us, in the heels of the Cole memo and the FinCEN guidance, our state regulators and the FDIC in March of 2014 took the stance where they did not object to their banks providing services. And I should note that that non-objection is a mile away from an approval, if you will. But that was the position that they gave us.
And who is that gave you that?
The FDIC and State of Oregon, in terms of we're a state chartered bank. State of Oregon's our primary regulator, and FDIC insured, they're also our regulator. The process to go through that involved a lot of education to try and understand, you know, the laws that are in place in Oregon, educate ourselves about the industry, about dispensaries, about growers, about processors, to ultimately come to a conclusion of how we could build a program that would fit within regulatory guidance. So we set about building out a program. We're fairly, well, extremely transparent with our regulators, following the FinCEN guidance, which primarily focuses on money laundering. And our role, you know, in monitoring this industry, it lies around that for the most part. Shared our program with our state and federal regulators, got their feedback, implemented those items, opened up a couple of accounts in August in Oregon, then went through an exam process, a joint exam by those regulators, where once again they could look at our program and kind of provide more feedback and constructive criticism, and we could work hard to implement that. So we went through that process and implemented their suggestions and continued down the path. So today we have probably about 100 accounts opened. That's probably 75-ish relationships, cross-section of dispensaries, of grow operations, of processors. Represents about $4 million in deposits at our bank. Let's see. I could so that in a nutshell is kind of how we got to where we're at. You know, hopefully you understand that there won't be many of us that'll take this step because of the process. You know, if I may apologize for the formality, so Co-Chair Linger, Co-Chair Burdick, and Senator Feroli, you had made a comment about no safe harbor, and that's exactly right. I got to spend some time in D.C. talking to regulators and talked to the OCC, the CFPB, to the FDIC. I even found a new regulator that supervises all of the state regulators. And Jeremiah Norton of the FDIC, you know, I asked him about this. You know, how is it that the FDIC can allow one of their banks, you know, to enter this space when there's this fear of you know, federal prosecution by the Department of Justice? His comment was, there's no safe harbor. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you nailed it. It's exactly, we have a risk, and where we're at is it's a risk assessment. You know, we know that what we do provides tremendous value, you know, not just to the industry in terms of access to banking, but the process of the monitoring, the due diligence, the filing of reports provides what we think is very valuable information to the federal government. Working closely with the states, you know, it's all part of an effort to ensure that we've got good business people, you know, wanting to do this business right. And so there's a tremendous amount of value in all that. So I don't know. I jotted some notes if you would like me to address some of the questions that were asked. I thought I could be helpful.
Oh, please do. Yes.
Okay. And I once again apologize if I do this incorrectly.
That's all right. But,
Co-Chair Burdick and Co-Chair Linger and Representative Buckley, you asked about an FRB account. The Federal Reserve Bank, you know, provides an account to us banks and credit unions and allows us to clear all of our activities. So when someone brings a check into our bank that, and they have an account at Bank of America and they deposit it, we give them some cash, we've got to get money from Bank of America. So that clears through the Fed to Bank of America. When someone wants to send a wire from our bank to another bank, it travels through the Fed. ACH, same thing. It's a movement from somebody's checking account to another checking account. It travels through the Fed. So they sit in the middle of all of the activity where money moves. And in addition, as cash is physically, cash is sent to the Fed, or the Fed sends cash to a financial institution. That's one of the other services they provide. So none of us can really do much of anything without an access to the Fed, either directly or through a correspondent relationship with another bank that's got a Fed account. Is that helpful?
It is very helpful. So if I could just ask, how are you then operating?
So the Federal Reserve will allow us to continue to operate in that we're a bank. We have a variety of customers. We transact in a very typical way. We've just added one piece of an industry, if you will, and that hasn't created a situation that would cause them not to, to continue to give us access.
Thank you.
Linda brings up a good point. We've been around for 20 years, and in fact, we're celebrating our 20th anniversary, and we're trying to note that this year as a result of we like to remind people that MBank has been around for 20 years. It wasn't created yesterday with the naming for the industry.
I'm glad you answered that.
Branding there.
Let's see if I say so. Co-chair Burdick, co-chair Lininger, Senator Brzezinski. I think there was a question asked about prosecution in California. One of the important things to understand is that the Cole memo is very specific in that it seems to provide some sort of cover for where you have a state-run program. So California's got lots of dispensaries and grow operations, but it's not licensed or run by the state. It's done by a municipality. And so there's a fear by many of us in the financial world that is not protection. And so some banks may aggressively interpret that, but in our case, we can't. So, for example, in the state of Washington, they have a licensed program for recreational use. They do not have a state-run program for medical use. And so that makes those of us in the industry nervous about whether we can serve that. I think there was a question that you asked about just deposit insurance. I had a chance to talk to the credit union in Colorado that you guys have mentioned, and I think they have a common mission like we do. We need to see an industry served. We need to see people with banking accounts, and so we collaborated or talked about their challenges. And so the FDIC, a federal agency, insures banks. The NCUA is a federal agency that insures credit unions. It's possible for a credit union to be state insured only or state licensed without that federal insurance, and then they would go out and they would obtain private insurance from some sort of insurance broker. So they could provide some sort of protection at a cost that I'm sure they'd have to pass on to their depositors. But with all that said, the critical aspect for that institution is they still need access to the Fed system, which is going to be tough for those guys. And then in another question that someone asked, Co-Chair Burdick, I think you asked this, as we built out our program with our regulators, it became very clear that we had to have the ability to walk away in short order, to make our regulators happy. So that required us to set a concentration limit of how much of our business could be in the marijuana industry, and then what resources do we have if we needed to shut the door on that on an overnight basis. So because of that focus by the federal government on limiting your exposure, and I find it really challenging for that poor credit union to get any kind of federal charter approval, given that they technically could be concentrated in one business, and so something bad happened, it would put that institution at risk and the insurance fund behind that at risk. And so I think that's a challenge there. Representative Olson, you asked about ongoing monitoring. I think, as part of our interpretation of the FinCEN memo or FinCEN guidance, we're required to do ongoing monitoring of these businesses. So for us, what that means is on a monthly basis, we get sales journals, we get purchase journals, we can figure out roughly what somebody's net cash should be. We can compare that to their actual deposit activity. And then we are accumulating and aware of industry metrics to kind of ensure that the activity that's flowing through our bank, you know, appears and seems to be reasonable based on their financial records. And I think that's the expectation by the guidance, is to do something like that. You know, it doesn't have to be that, but that is our interpretation of how we do that. You know, we have a pretty rigorous front-end process to, on a due diligence side, to sign people up, background checks, corporate documents, financial statements, tax returns, all that stuff, to really understand, you know, where the funding of this business came from, how it came to exist, and then this ongoing monitoring helps us do what we think we need to do in terms of compliance.
Madam Chair, can I just jump in on that for a moment?
Yeah, sure. We're running a little short on time, so we have to...
question, and might close what you just said for me for a loop on that. Now, do you provide banking service for a marijuana grower who is unlicensed?
No.
Okay, that's all. I was just trying to close that loop. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Representative Wilson, you'd asked a question. Just to clarify on the SAR filings, the SARs are suspicious activity reports. They're a product that banks are supposed to, when they see something odd, they make a note of it and they file this report. You know, we have a sense that it goes into some nebulous warehouse. We believe, you know, what generally happens is if someone's prosecuted for something, they probably look at that information and try and get corroborating evidence of something inappropriate going on. But it's hard to see where people directly respond to that. So the powers that be in terms of FinCEN is determined in the first 30 days of an account. We're required to file a suspicious activity report, and every 90 days on an ongoing basis we file. And in our case, our SARs also include sales activity in terms of, and financial activity for that institution. And I suspect folks like the IRS and others appreciate being able to access that kind of information when it comes to potential tax return review. I think that was all the questions that I had notes on.
Let me just break in here and see if Mr. Ryan wants to testify before we continue with more questions.
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Lininger, and the rest of the committee. I'm Casey Ryan, Senior Vice President of Corporate Development. I'm on the front part of it. I work with most of the clients on the starting the process of gathering the applications and making sure that we get everything going. And it's a long, you know, process. And then I do site visits, and I'm the one that's on the front half of everything. So I can answer any questions that you have about, you know, dealing with, you know, the customers and what that process looks like.
I have a question. Do you have only dispensaries as customers, or do you have growers as well?
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Lininger, and the committee. We have
back off from the mic. Oh, it's very sensitive.
Yeah, I did say 12 inches. So, one thing that was really surprising is, you know, we have processors or growers. We have medibles or edibles, people who make the THC and the whatever that goes in the foods and the different things. And then we do have dispensaries. One thing that we didn't see coming as much is the ancillary businesses. And so a lot of banks, if you're cannabis related whatsoever, there's laboratories that just test they call them flowers, and there's a bunch of industries out there, like there are businesses out there, and we've picked up a lot of those. And those just go into standard business accounts. Now, we still put them into the high-risk accounts, and we do file initial SARs because of the high risk. But after that, unless there's any other activity that seems somewhat suspicious, they operate with us with no monthly monitoring or anything.
And what percentage of your business would you say is marijuana-related, and what percentage is your target, or what would be your maximum?
I haven't thought about actual percentages, but at $4 million in deposits, and you know, and our bank probably has about $140 million in deposits. So at this point, it's pretty small. We've been asked to consider maybe around a $20 million cap in terms of as a percentage of who we are and what we are. And that plays into the amount of capital that we have behind the bank, and to the extent we want to have a greater concentration or figure out a strategy to move some of those accounts or balances off balance sheet, we would probably need to figure out how to add capital to the bank to support growth in that way.
Thank you. Other questions? Quick ones. Very quick ones.
Madam Chair, thank you. Two things. First of all, congressional action, which would resolve the problem, I think is years away because it's politically risky. So I think they're unlikely to take this issue up until many more states have considered the issue and acted in the affirmative. What do you think about a memorandum of agreement with federal regulators that would give you a document that perhaps the state of Oregon would negotiate with federal regulators on behalf of those banks and credit unions that want to enter into this business?
Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Linger, Senator Farrelly, that would be wonderful.
Okay, and Madam Chair,
we will assign you to do that.
Yes, Senator, thank you, Madam Chair, and I will. And if nominated, I will run. yes. So really coming from the natural resources background, forestry and some of the other stuff, the changes in policy, the detrimental changes in policy are evident across the state of Oregon. So I guess I would just caution you, if you wonder whether you can trust the U.S. government, ask a Native American.
Okay.
Co-Chair Burdick, Representative Littinger, Senator Farrelly, that's not very encouraging.
Not very encouraging.
Since you already answered most of the questions, did you have something to add?
I just thank you, Co-Chair Burdick. I wanted to just add that we've talked largely about deposit account relationships today. I know that Chair Leininger brought up access to capital. That is a space that you will really not find almost any financial institutions in yet. There are some very specific laws. Mr. Scoggins did a good job outlining some of those, but when you have seizure and forfeiture rights of the government, it calls into question how you would make those loans and have any certainty about the collateral or the ability to collect on those loans. We hope that over time there's some clarity there, but that's almost a whole nother conversation that we haven't even really gotten to today. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
No, and I really appreciate that. He listed that as, I think, his second highest risk, and based on his testimony, I thought that was the first highest risk, although maybe RICO, as Senator Farrelly just pointed out.
Yeah, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, just on the lending front, Linda's right. I mean, there's no one that's really willing to step up and do lending. We're working with some private money that is interested in providing loans and debt, both for real estate and then for expansion. And I think to the extent we can figure out how to facilitate getting money to this industry, into this space, that will contribute to its growth. And I think that's worthwhile. But right now, it'll be private money, people that assess the risk. And just as a small aside, if anybody in this industry knows what they're doing, they should be able to pay back a loan within 1 year. Almost not enough time to get into trouble. So,
okay, thank you. And thank you so much. It has been very educational.
Thank you.
Yes. And I hope we can continue the conversation. All right. Our last panel tonight is law enforcement issues, drug recognition, DUI, the whole nine yards. And we have an Oregon State Police panel along with Dina Ryerson from the Attorney General's office. Welcome. Is it just the two of you?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Rick, you can come up if you want. All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Well, good evening, Co-Chairs Liniger and Burdick and members of the committee. I want to introduce myself. My name is Sergeant Evan Sether with the Oregon State Police. I run the Drug Evaluation and Classification Program, which is a statewide program that deals with the training and implementation of drug recognition procedures as it pertains to DUI investigations. So I'll give you a brief kind of an opportunity to review the training procedures as well as the state of the program as it sits right now and some of the tools that we have currently available to combat drug-impaired driving. So the initial training that any officer is going to get when they go through the academy in Oregon is the standardized field sobriety testing procedures, DUI procedures, report writing, as well as breath testing equipment, certifications, and then that total encompasses 32 hours, and then there's an additional 8 hours that encompasses drugs that impair driving, which is a curriculum that's required under OAR for certain procedures that pertains to the drug DUIs. And that's kind of more of a foundational type of thing for initial entry into law enforcement as this kind of typical kind of patrol officer. So it's really, it's a foundational thing. It is not the you know, the apex of the training that they would receive. There's some additional training that comes up as they gain more experience in the field just through normal DUI investigations, as well as they start to, I guess, exhibit some proficiency and a demonstrated proficiency in those investigations. One of those is advanced roadside impaired driving enforcement, and I believe the committee should have just a kind of an outline of some of the statistics and some of the names. So if I use some phrases or acronyms, you should know what they mean. But A-Ride is a 16-hour course that's a little more in-depth with respect to drug-impaired driving, some basic kind of overview of human physiology, some elements in there that to get a better understanding of how drugs affect the body and how they present at a typical roadside DUI investigation. And along with that, you can see some statistics below in on that first page of my written testimony that shows where we're at in terms of when training was first rolled out in 2009 here in Oregon, how many officers total have been trained on that. And you can see the breakdown of who's Oregon State Police right now, currently 93, 311 from municipal agencies, 123 from the county, and 3 from federal, like Bureau of Land Management or Forest Service employees that are law enforcement officers. But that represents, again, a pretty small segment of the population of law enforcement officers. And, again, those officers sometimes go off into different assignments. Criminal divisions are promoted, and so they're not necessarily in patrol capacities anymore. The next kind of phase, the next, I guess, what you'd think of as kind of the apex of the drug recognition training or drug DUI training that officers receive is the availability of the Drug Recognition Expert Program, DRE program. Which is the primary function that I hold here in the state. This is a program that exists internationally. Its primary focus here is here in the United States, where all 50 states have a DRE program now, but it's also implemented in Canada, the United Kingdom. This is a pretty intense training program. And the second page of my testimony kind of outlines some of the initial kind of application process, but in order to get into this process, you actually have to submit an application that has to have recommendations from local prosecutors as well as recommendations from local drug recognition experts that are already proficient in this. They have to submit reports reviewed by a panel and then selected. They have to obviously demonstrate proficiency in both drug and DUI investigations and also through what their field sobriety testing proficiencies. So if they are accepted, then they go through a rigorous classroom training environment, which is 72 hours long. There's an additional 40 hours of field certifications where they're actually putting these procedures and evaluation procedures into play. And then there's at the end of that, there's a comprehensive written final examination, which takes approximately 8 to 10 hours. So when we throw everything in together, it's approximately 3 weeks of training specific to drug recognition, drug categories, procedures, and some elements. We have physicians that come in and teach certain elements with respect to human physiology. We have an optometrist that comes in and talks about the eye examinations and pupil size elements there. So we have some, for lack of better words, VIP people that come in to provide that instruction. But it's not just the initial training that we get. Certainly, we have to maintain continuing education, so we have a certain number of hours that we need to have. We also need to maintain certification and actually demonstrate proficiency through having correct opinions. And I'll address kind of how our protocol goes so that you have an understanding of why it's important that we're proficient and that we're accurate in our opinions. But to go back to the recertification process, they need to make sure that they're strictly adhering DRE policies, which we now outline, and that they have the continuing education, and that there's a constant dialogue to make sure that they're up to speed on the current drug trends, methods of ingestion, and things like that, so that they're well equipped for their investigations. Now, what I would like to do is go into kind of a summary of what we do, like how DREs actually become involved in the process of DUI investigations. This is not a typical roadside type of a program. DREs become involved, towards the end or in the middle of a DUI investigation. A typical kind of DUI would begin. Would typically arise out of a traffic stop for some moving violation or equipment violation or something like that. And a patrol officer, whoever makes that stop, would encounter that driver, and in that course of that, they would see various signs of impairment through the cognitive types of impairment, physical signs of impairment, and maybe perhaps the driving, the time, place, and circumstances of that contact, to where they could actually then form, suspicion, probable cause that this person is impaired. And then through that procedure, they would then ask the driver, they'll perform field sobriety tests, go through a field sobriety test screening, what we would typically think of as, like the eye test, the walk and turn test, the one leg stand, kind of a standard battery. At that point, an officer, based on the totality of the circumstances, including their observations of the person, how they're behaving, maybe driving issues, if there's witnesses, poor driving that alerted law enforcement to begin with, all that is taken into consideration. The officer makes a decision whether or not the person is impaired to a perceptible or noticeable degree. They had to have probable cause, obviously, to making that arrest. If they make that arrest, then they'll take somebody down to a normal breath test procedure, where if the person blows under 0.08, and there's some reasonable suspicion that drugs are involved, then they would request a DRE to come down and do an independent evaluation of that person. There's a few other circumstances where we may be involved, but typically it's encountering where alcohol is less than an 0.08, or there's no alcohol in the system, and there has to be at least reasonable suspicion that drugs are some sort of impairing substance other than alcohol is at play. There may be circumstances where in fatal or serious injury collisions, we're going to come out and evaluate if there's some, we may actually come out and actually have contact with the driver at roadside to kind of maybe get an idea during maybe an interview type of a process, but not as a standard kind of a DRE protocol, which I'll outline now. So in the event that a DRE is called down, what we'll do is we'll come down. We have a 12-step process, which is systematic and standardized, so we do it the exact same way every time. So once we get down there, we'll get an interview with the arresting officer to kind of get an idea of what the context of the stop was, how they came in contact with it. Was it a crash? Was it a standard DUI stop? What observations did the officer make? Were there any other signs and symptoms, any other evidence at the scene or in the car that might be relevant? And then we'll actually start encountering the person. And this is where we'll actually ask questions of them, kind of get an idea of medical history, assessing their current kind of cognitive functions, asking them basic questions about what time they think it is, what the date is, their medical history, when they last slept, when they last ate, things like that. At that point, we move into some eye examinations where some of these tests that we do are the exact same ones that are done at the side of the road, but we're doing them in a controlled environment, typically at a police station, for instance, a state police patrol office, something like that, not at roadside. Then we'd move into divided attention tests, where we would do, again, kind of like a walk and turn test, a one leg stand, but we'd also do a couple additional tests. We'd be assessing people's internal clocks through the estimation of time. We'd also be doing like a finger to nose test. There's several physical tests, but what we're trying to assess is is the person's ability to divide their attention and do simple, you know, let's say simple complex tasks, like, you know, that might seem strange, but putting somebody in the position to have to listen to instructions, understand those instructions, remember to do those instructions, and perform those actually physically, and assessing whether there's memory issues, cognition, whether they're forgetting, or any physical signs that may manifest during that. We're also assessing people's vital signs, so we're trained to take pulses, we're trained to assess blood pressure, we're trained to take temperatures via an oral thermometer. And all that goes, you know, is recorded contemporaneously on an evaluation report. Then we move in, we start assessing pupil sizes and seeing whether they're normal or abnormal given the lighting conditions, whether they're reacting appropriately to the introduction of light. And then we're also looking for signs of ingestion. We're seeing whether there's anything that's abnormal about the hands or within the mouth or in the nasal cavities, signs of injection, things like that that might indicate a recent use of a drug through what the typical kind of ways that drugs are administered or ingested. We'll also look at muscle rigidity, and then we'll sit down and we'll actually talk to the person and interview them about their drug use that, you know, that evening or within the last 24 hours or whatever thing that may be relevant to our investigation. And at that point, based on that entire evaluation, and again, we're evaluating that person on how they performed during that time, not necessarily how they performed at roadside because the conditions may be different and time has passed. At that point, the DRE renders an opinion as to whether they believe the person is impaired or not. If they believe the person is impaired, then they're going to assess, is this a drug impairment or is there some other explanation for what's going on here? If it's a drug impairment, then what category of drugs or combinations of categories of drugs are causing that? So with that, they render that opinion, they write that report, but part of that process is currently a collection of a toxicology sample, which is in this, our current procedure is a collection of a urine sample. And then that's submitted to the lab later for testing, and then that is, that toxicology has to, essentially, is kind of a confirmatory step. It needs to corroborate the observations of the officer and the opinion of what the officer is. So, for instance, I need to have, in essence, I need to maintain a high level of accuracy with respect to my opinions, and I need to make sure that those are confirmed through toxicology at a minimum standard. And in Oregon, our program does a very good job of that. At last year's data, just as a side note, where we currently stand with the toxicology, with the evaluations that we have in, approximately 80% of them are in, but right now 90% of our opinions have been corroborated through toxicology in our current thing. So that's kind of an overview of what the DRE program does, where it's implemented. I'm happy to answer any of the committee's questions with respect to that area of expertise.
I think what we're trying to get a handle on is what changes, if any, we need to make in light of recreational marijuana. It sounds to me like you already have an established system in place for testing for marijuana or other drug intoxication that are not alcohol, which you have the breathalyzer for. So what are your thoughts on that?
Co-Chair Berta, Co-Chair Lineker, and members of the committee. We have a number of tools that are available to us right now, and a number of tools that are very effective. Certainly, the state police, in conjunction with all of the other DREs and the other agencies that are involved, and even at the national level, we're evaluating what other states do and the benefits, the limits, and the benefits of particular tools that they have in place. You know, as it comes to toxicology, currently Oregon is a urine state, and that's typically how we are collecting those urine sample or collecting those samples for analysis. In certain cases, the blood samples may be collected, but that's not a standard type of a process. It's not the way that the crime lab is typically geared to address this issue. In terms of additional tools, where the state police has identified initial issues is training more officers to recognize the signs of drug impairment at the intermediate level. The A-Ride class that I mentioned, that two-day additional training, is really the initial focus is to get more training to those officers so that they're actually recognizing them making those decisions. The DRE program, we anticipate there will be there's a possibility there'll be an impact in terms of we may need more DREs across the state and in certain geographical areas where we may have shortages, especially on the east side of this east region of the state. The difficulty is it's hard to guess exactly how much. We've got some initial data coming from Colorado and Washington in terms of incidents of marijuana impaired driving, but it's difficult to say exactly how much that will have an impact, you know, both financially and in terms of just basic resources, how much of a time load that will actually put on DREs. Because all these DREs have other functions. They're not full-time DREs. There are a lot of them are patrol officers. Some are detectives. Some work in a lottery investigation. Some are in administration and whatnot. So it's difficult to say.
Madam Chair.
Representative Olson,
Sergeant,
calling on you first.
Thank you. How difficult is it to determine whether somebody's under the influence of marijuana?
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Olson, it's pretty straightforward. There are very consistent signs and observable effects with respect to marijuana impairment. It's just making sure that officers are educated about those.
Right. Okay, so just follow up then, Madam Chair. Okay, but you do not need to go through the initial 16 hours worth of training in order to determine that.
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Olson, that is correct. There is an initial training that they get in the academy, drugs that impair driving, which does cover in that time drug symptomology, and marijuana along with other cannabis products is included in that curriculum. Yes, so they can make those drug driving arrests based on that training alone.
Okay, just follow up again. Are you familiar with the Smooth Eye Corporation field sobriety test right now that's being developed back in Virginia? And right now it's boasting that it has the capability of measuring the sobriety of a person smoking cannabis. Have you ever heard of that?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Olson, no, I have not. You said it's the Smooth Eye Corporation?
Yeah, it's Smooth Eye. Yeah, I can talk to you afterwards, but I find it rather interesting. It's news to me. And can I follow up just a little bit more? Okay, so
have you ever favorite subject.
Thank you. Have you ever done any drug interdiction?
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Olson, I have done in some limited capacity. My expertise has been in DUI investigations in my 10-year career. So it's, in some sense, interdictions come out of DUIs. Sometimes we'll find people in large possessions, possession of large quantities of drugs as a result of those DUI investigations.
Okay. So I'm trying to do a connection here with the little bit of experience you've had with the interdiction process of it. We had Rob Patridge here a few weeks back. He's the commissioner right now of the
OLCC.
OLCC. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, those guys.
He mentioned, from what I recall, that he had heard that at least 75% of the medical marijuana that was being grown in Southern Oregon was actually being diverted out of the state. So there was a pipeline going out to other states across the country. Have you heard that, or do you think that's right?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Olson, I believe that's outside my level of expertise. And I couldn't provide definitive information on that. I could certainly reach out and try to attempt to answer that question for you or refer you to somebody who could answer that question.
And then just one more. Okay, thank you. Have you been tracking then what's going on with Washington and Colorado for WSP back up north, and then also with Colorado State Patrol for what's happening with their increase in DUI arrests because of marijuana?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Olson, yes, we are aware of the initial statistics that are coming out of Colorado State Patrol, Denver PD, as well as the state of Washington.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, thank you very much, and you get to back clean up, Dina.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, Chair Leninger, and members of the committee, my name is Dina Ryerson, and I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the Oregon's DUI resource prosecutor nationally. I'm known as the traffic safety resource prosecutor. Almost every state in the country has a traffic safety resource prosecutor. I'm Oregon's. Several states have more than one, but I'm the one for Oregon. In my role as a traffic safety resource prosecutor, I've actually worked exclusively in the area of impaired driving in Oregon for the last 8.5 years, and prior to that I was a prosecutor in Washington County. My main role is to train law enforcement and prosecutors in all area of impaired driving, and I've had the opportunity to be involved in DUI legislation every year for the last 8.5 years, so I'm familiar with a lot of the processes that have gone behind a lot of the DUI laws that have passed in the last many years. I'm mainly here to answer technical questions, but I did want to bring up a few things with the committee, things to consider in the area of prosecution and in prosecuting DUIs. As Sergeant Sether mentioned, primarily prosecution is about proving impairment in driving, and that's the goal of any Senator Brzezinski's nodding his head because he's very well familiar with it, and that's our goal. And then the question becomes, what evidence do we have to prove somebody's impaired by any substance? And we have several pieces of evidence, and as Sergeant Sether mentioned, we have field sobriety tests, we have drug recognition experts, and this is in the area of drug DUIs. And this assumes a person agrees to participate in the evaluation. There are often times that people do not want to participate in the drug recognition evaluation. It's a consensual thing. In prosecuting my own fair share of cases and in hearing from prosecutors across the state, prosecuting DUIs when marijuana is involved is difficult in some cases, and it all depends on the level of impairment that's being exhibited at roadside and later on through the investigation. And just a comment on one question that was asked. Some of the issues that prosecutors are facing and that they tell me all the time is, so depending on the dose of marijuana, it's really about cognitive impairment that the officers are seeing on the road. And we have drug recognition experts who are a lot better equipped, if they are the ones who are arresting the person or going through the evaluation, to be able to articulate those signs of impairment to the jury and present the evidence in a way that the jury and the judge can then make a fully informed decision on what is being observed. And that, of course, requires, you know, training on the part of more law enforcement to be able to detect this type of impairment at a level that, you know, some of the drug recognition experts can get to. The other piece of evidence is the toxicological sample that we collect. We are one of very few states left in the country that collect urine as the sample. The vast majority of the rest of the states collect blood, and it's a routine process. Washington and Colorado collect blood as their toxicology sample, and the primary reason is because, and if we're really talking about DUIs involving marijuana, is because the blood can detect the active ingredient of marijuana in the urine, or in the blood, the THC in the blood. And so that's the primary reason most of the rest of the country uses blood, and not just for marijuana DUIs. For all drug DUIs, they use blood, and that's because it can give you some idea of more recency of use rather than the urine sample, where the limitations are, you know, I've heard from our crime lab, you can use marijuana and 30 days later it'll still come up in the urine. So that's a very limited tool that prosecutors have to rely on in prosecuting the cases. And assuming Oregon follows the pattern of Colorado and Washington and sees an increase in marijuana-related DUIs, which is anticipated, we have statistics from Denver saying, you know, in Denver alone they had from 2013 to 2014 double the number of marijuana-related DUIs in their city, and that's just the city of Denver, which I think is understandable if that's one of the main areas that there's a lot of industry. But that being said, with an increase in the number of DUIs and the limited value of urine as the toxicological sample, not only that's something to consider is that there will be a lot more cases, not only in the judicial system, but a lot more that will go to trial, a lot more that will have, well, a lot more that will go to trial, a lot more that will go through the process and take resources that way. So that's something for the committee to consider. Another thing is within the DRE process, as Sergeant Sether talked to you about, there's a 12-step process that they go through when the person agrees to submit to a drug evaluation. If they do not provide a urine sample, and again, that although implied consent requires it, it's still not, it's still something that they can say they don't want to do. And if they do not provide it, we're in a situation where the remainder of the steps that the drug recognition expert collected and saw evidence of impairment, it's not uniform how the courts in the state allow the admissibility of the rest of that evidence, the other steps in that evidence. And so one thing to consider, there's House Bill 2371 that says, look, if the person does not agree to submit to a urine sample, then the remainder of the steps come into evidence for the jury and the judge, whoever's the trier of fact, to consider when determining if the person's impaired. And that's a tool that this committee can consider providing to prosecution and law enforcement, as you know, as all the evidence as he was suggesting that they collect of impairment, they get to consider and making it uniform across the state. The other thing that something for the committee to consider is Measure 91 does not address passenger smoking, and I specifically say smoking in this case versus edible marijuana. Smoking marijuana, passenger smoking, it of course addresses using marijuana while smoking, I believe, is a Class B violation. Of course, that's separate than if you have a DUI and you're impaired, then that's a DUI, which is currently a crime. But passengers who smoke marijuana, and the concern, of course, is any kind of passive inhalation or passive impairment that would come to the driver. So if you roll up all the windows and everybody in the car is smoking marijuana, that might be a problem for the driver becoming impaired. And would, of course, then be a crime to drive impaired, regardless if you, however it happens. And so that's a concern for the committee to consider, that might not be a great idea to have passengers smoking marijuana in the car with the driver. And the other thing that I'd wanted to mention is tools also for prosecutors in training. I'm pretty much the only person, other than if there's in-house training, that trains prosecutors across state. I just finished a prosecuting the drug driver course that was a combined effort between the drug recognition program and prosecutors. We trained about 25 prosecutors, 25 drug recognition experts. But with the increase of marijuana-related DUIs, it would also require prosecutors to be trained. So that's something that to consider as well. And finally, Representative Olson touched on it a little bit. You know, technology needs to develop. I had just heard recently of the eye testing, but I had never heard of it before. I've heard of potential breath type testing. I've heard oral swab testing, which is one of the probably the most to this point researched tool that potentially law enforcement can use. I don't think from what I've researched and heard, the technology's not quite there yet, but getting close. But still, some resources to look towards the future that can give law enforcement, take oral fluid testing. We just had the Oregon's DRE conference the last 2 days, and someone presented about oral fluid testing, something that can be done at roadside with law enforcement. And there's a lot of positive things coming out of that, and something that could potentially be researched in the future. A lot of states are looking at those things as different tools.
Let's wrap this up so we can get some questions. Do you have any final
and that was it?
Parting shots? Okay.
That was actually
great. Okay. Do we have any questions in our limited time? Senator Cruz.
Just a brief one, because you talk about somebody else smoking in a car. Wouldn't that be treated the same as open container? I mean, theoretically.
Co-Chair Rudick, Co-Chair Lininger, sorry. I know that There's different. I can't remember all the limitations in Measure 91 about using marijuana in the car. I know there are some outlined, but I mean, as far as possessing it, I'm just not sure. But if a passenger is smoking marijuana and it affects the driver, then that would be the.
Oh, but even in alcohol open container, the driver's liable, even though he isn't drinking. So.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. You talked about blood tests, and our state doesn't use them. Besides just changing statute to require that or to allow that, would that be the step that you recommend to us?
Madam Chair, I'd like to tell you that is a lot easier. Representative Buckley, we currently can do it. We can get a warrant right now and take someone's blood to look for evidence of marijuana. The problem is our crime lab is equipped to test for urine.
Gotcha.
And so if we want to test it, then an agency or the DA's office has to pay a private lab to do the testing.
Gotcha.
So.
Last question, Representative Olson. It better be good.
Oh, yeah, it's good. It's good. Are you in favor of us creating a level for THC level in a person for operating a motor vehicle like what Washington has done with, I think it was 5 nanograms, is that what it is?
Madam Co-Chairs and Representative Olson, I will give an example to make it very short. I cannot give a position, uh-huh. but I will give you the concerns about that. First of all, the 5 nanogram level is really based on a study of people who were tested at the time of driving in that study. The short story is that there are significant concerns when you're talking about law enforcement and DUI cases and the time it would take to get the blood. And by the time you go through the whole process that Sergeant Souther described, and by the time you get the warrant and you get the blood, all the evidence shows that the nanograms in the blood will be under 5, and 70% of the cases will be under 5 nanograms. And the one example I will give you, and then I'll be done, is a case out of Washington State in July of last year. A person was stopped for various reasons. The bong was in his lap, along with the marijuana. He was asked to do field sobriety test, and he said, and I quote, "I'm high as a kite." He later thanked the officer for pulling him over, but the time of the stop, they ended up going through all the steps that Sergeant Souther mentioned. From the time of the stop to the time the blood was drawn from him, so he said, "I was impaired, the bong was in his lap." The level of his blood was 2.5 nanograms in 2 hours and 17 minutes after. So that kind of gives you an idea of the problems.
Hey, Senator Farioli has a concluding
and
question.
Senator Prozanski.
You wanted a question, too?
Of course. So, Madam Chair, if the DRE protocol is voluntary, at what point do you have to document that it's not just an implied consent but an actual consent? And how do you do that?
Madam Co-Chairs and Senator Farioli, implied consent is not attached to the drug recognition program. So there is no sanction such as if you refuse a breath test, you're going to get a license suspension.
No, that's my question is how do you demonstrate that the individual who the officer believes is impaired has actually consented to the DRE protocol? Do you have him sign a consent form?
Or on tape. Most of these are going
to
be recorded.
I'd like to have the witness answer. Thank you.
I'm just helping.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farioli, procedurally, there's a couple different ways. As Senator Prozanski mentioned, some of these evaluations are recorded. That has not been established as a statewide policy as to whether to do that or not. Some are video recorded. It depends on the particular agencies and their own policies. One of the other ways is through express consent, where somebody verbally, we ask, "Are you willing to undergo this evaluation?" And we outline the steps, and the person says yes or no. In other cases, it's written. There's not a stock form. It's typically on a case-by-case basis as the officer assesses during their contact with that person.
And, Madam Chair, if the individual who's given consent asks to break off the DRE protocol, you can use everything up to that point, but you can't continue.
No, they said no.
Madam Co-Chairs and Senator Farioli, we would certainly document what we observed at that point. but it would not be considered, say, if they stopped halfway through, it would not be considered a complete evaluation and would therefore not be a complete 12-step protocol, which would allow us to testify in court about as a protocol. So we would essentially have, and then again, as Ms. Ryerson mentioned, it's a hodgepodge mix in terms of court by court, whether certain elements of that would be included or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Przanski.
I'll pass, and with the understanding that, one, we'll have access to Dina and to the sergeant, I'm assuming.
They will be back, and that, you are a great American.
And it's my understanding, you know, as the measure says, we're supposed to get a report back from OLCC as to what research is being done, and it sounds like they're going to keep us advised, so thanks.
So a reminder, we will not be meeting Monday, and you can look for some bills to be posted Wednesday, and we are adjourned. And we are adjourned. Bills to be posted Wednesday.